Shabbat Shalom. In every generation, Jews have openly wondered whether theirs would be the last Jewish generation to walk on this earth. The pattern began with none other than our founding patriarch, Abraham, who, childless into his old age, watches his eldest son, Ishmael, go on to become the father of another nation. At the beginning of today's Torah reading, Jackson described, Abraham's wife, Sarah, the matriarch of our people, passes from this earth. His youngest son, Isaac, understandably scarred from his near-death experience at the top of Mount Moriah, and not to mention the therapy-inducing circumstance of growing up in the home of the founding father of ethical monotheism, was showing no sign of putting himself out there on J-Date, J-Swipe, J-Crush, or any other Jewish dating platform. Fertility problems were an open secret in the first family, not to mention the looming shadow of late marriage and non-marriage. God forbid, Abraham tells his servant Eliezer, that his son Isaac should take a daughter of Canaan for a wife. Go unto my country, to my kindred, to take a wife for my son Isaac, Abraham orders. Abraham would not be the last Jewish parent to intervene in order to secure Jewish grandchildren, setting the stage for Adin Steinsaltz's observation that a Jew is not one whose grandparents are Jewish, but one who wants his or her grandchildren to be Jewish. The stakes were too high to take any chances. Our very survival as a Jewish people was on the line, and Abraham was prepared to do whatever it took to make sure that his, the first Jewish generation, would not be the last. I've been long fond of quoting Simon Rabinowitz's famous essay bearing the name Israel, the Ever-Dying People, in which he relates that every age and stage of Jewish existence has believed itself to be the last one, be it by way of persecution, dispersion, or the forces of assimilation. We are a people with a perennial belief that we are at risk of extinction until, of course, the next generation arrives, utterly convinced of the same. As Rabinowitz argues, the fact of our multi-millennial against-the-odds survival as a people has been not due merely to the presence of this ever-dying anxiety, but rather that this mentality has been leveraged to action in every generation, producing responses capable of bridging us from strength to strength, one generation to the next. And now, it's this generation's moment to respond to our people's recurring cri de cœur. The numbers speak for themselves. Some 70% of born Jews marrying non-Jews. Study after study reveals what we see with our own eyes, the precipitous decline in the Jewishly engaged, or what Dr. Stephen Cohen identifies as the Jewish middle. And while the fact of a single lost soul is of ultimate concern, the compounded effects of this decline are increasingly palpable on the community as a whole. Federations, JCCs, Jewish day schools, and synagogues are all, to put it mildly, feeling the pinch. Unlike, say, debates on global warming in our post-truth world, on this one, the facts aren't really in dispute. The effects are there in plain sight. The question we face is the same question faced by Abraham, faced by every Jewish generation. What must we do to ensure that we are not the last Jewish generation? You know, it was a great honor to welcome Dr. Shaul Magid and Dr. Stephen Cohen into our community as they squared off on this very subject just a few weeks ago. I want to thank my dear colleague, Rabbi Zuckerman, for making the evening possible, the kickoff to a community conversation on the boundaries of American Jewry. While the ostensible topic of the evening was how the conservative movement should respond to the challenge of intermarriage, it was the question that lay beneath the surface of their remarks, which is a question that I believe sits at the crux of American Jewry's present choices, and to which I'd like to speak to today. Both in his remarks that evening and in a soon-to-be-published article, Dr. Magid outlines two historic responses to this anxiety over Jewish continuity. The first he calls survivalism, and the second he calls renewal. The survivalist instinct takes on many forms. Its goal, as the name suggests, the physical survival of Jews at all costs. When threatened, we create Jewish defense leagues. When loved too much by our non-Jewish neighbors, prompting fears of assimilation, we circle the wagons, Abraham-like, creating networks of Jewish identity to stack the odds in favor of us having Jewish grandchildren. Renewal, on the other hand, sees the same worrisome landscape, but responds to it not with an eye to saving the Jewish people or even defining what Judaism is or isn't, but rather, quote, liberating and transforming Judaism from a state of atrophy to a state of vitality. Engaging curriculum, musical creativity, spirited prayer, ritual innovation, these are the interventions of a renewalist that seek radical transformation of Jewish expression in order to create a Jewish renaissance. In practical terms, the survivalist and the renewal categories are easy to track in the world. ADL's fight against anti-Semitism, AIPAC's fight against the Iran deal, these are efforts aimed at Jewish survival. So too, arguably, a program like Birthright, which, God bless it, is really a fabulously successful Jewish mating ritual that is all about the survival of the Jewish people. Jewish renewal, on the other hand, Magid argues, can be found in the efforts of the movement bearing its name, Jewish Renewal, but also Chabad and elsewhere, all efforts aimed at bringing out the essence of Judaism and the essential Jewish spark buried deep within every Jew. So too, I would argue, any venture, cultural, religious, educational, or otherwise, whose purpose is to bring forth the most dynamic expression of Jewish life and living, independent of ideological framework, that is Jewish renewal at work. And even if you weren't at last week's lecture, I imagine you can sense by now that given the choice of the tactics of survival or renewal, it is the latter in Dr. Magid's case, it is renewal in Dr. Magid's case that recommends itself for the Jewish future. No game, he argues, is won by playing defense. In order to win the Jewish future, the Jewish people must field a dynamic and compelling Judaism, a Judaism worth defending, a Judaism that is, if necessary, willing to draw outside of the lines if in doing so it succeeds in attracting those who stand at the edges and beyond the edges of the community. Living in fear of the non-Jew who hates us or loves us too much is just not a winning strategy. Furthermore, without a vibrant Judaism, what exactly, the reasoning goes, is a point of Jewish survival at all? As stated best by Sadia Gaon, Jews exist for the sake of Torah alone. The focus of the renewalist is on that Torah, not on survival merely for the sake of survival. And while time doesn't permit me to do justice to his position, it's clear both by way of the evening and his published and unpublished writing that Dr. Cohen believes otherwise. Dr. Cohen's flips Sadia Gaon's aforementioned dictum on its head, arguing, Im ein Yehudim, ein Yahudut. If there are no Jews, then there is no Judaism. Valuable as good rabbis, cantors, and educators may be, investments in religious inspiration will not, according to Cohen, ensure the Jewish future. We must redouble our efforts, in his mind, to strengthen Jewish social networks in cities, in high schools, on campuses, summer camps, Israel trips, preschools, and otherwise, giving Jews every opportunity to do Jewish with other Jews. We must invest in youth groups, Moshe houses, conversion efforts, and Jewish public education with the hope that such efforts, more Jewish parents will approach Jewish child rearing with greater information and intentionality. We can never go back to the shtetl, but if we want a Jewish future, we need Jews, which means we need to enact a series of interventions to create a close-knit Jewish community. These are the efforts, the survivalist argues, that will ensure the Jewish future. The debate was and remains a good one. If you missed it, you can listen to it on Park Avenue Podcast, or you can come to our next lecture on December 12th. If nothing else, it's a great discussion because the categories of survival and renewal are incredibly useful tools to frame priorities, not just as an American Jewish community, but right here in the synagogue. You see, oftentimes we measure our efforts by the categories of tradition and change, liberal or conservative, or more often than not, denominational affiliation, orthodox, conservative, and reform. What if, I wonder, if forward-thinking Jews asked a different question, the question of what percentage of what we are doing and what we're supporting is aimed at Jewish renewal, and what percentage is aimed at Jewish survival? Are we writing checks to ADL and AIPAC, but forgetting to fund synagogues, day schools, and those places training the next generations of Jewish educators, rabbis, and cantors? Are we telling our children that we want Jewish grandchildren, but neglecting to model Jewish lives worthy of emulation? And so too the opposite. Even the best rabbis and cantors will not stem the demographic exodus we face. The forces of assimilation are more formidable than any one sermon can counter. The most effective prayer circle or study group will not serve to protect Israel against her hostile neighbors or American Jewry against populist strains of anti-Semitism in our midst. As the speakers themselves ultimately acknowledge, it's not either or, it's both and. The categories are complementary, not competitive. And many efforts like Jewish camping, day school, and for that matter, the State of Israel fit squarely within both. There's also a chicken and egg aspect to the debate. What comes first, a strong Judaism or a strong Jewish community? The answer, is, of course, is they're interdependent. Each effort needs the other to succeed. No different than any portfolio that seeks balance amongst a variety of investment options, each one of us and our congregation as a whole must make sure that our efforts are allocated judiciously. We must light Shabbat candles, and we must fight anti-Semitism. We must send our kids on birthright, and we must invest in Jewish education, and so on and so forth. The critical scene of our Torah reading was when Eliezer, charged with the mission of finding his master's son a spouse of suitable lineage, stands at the crossroads, the Jewish future on the line, and he prays for guidance. It was precisely then, before he'd even finished his chair, that Rebekah appears and draws water from the well. For Eliezer, for his camels, an act both physically restorative and, more importantly, signaling the spiritual revitalization which he sought. The combination of her lineage, combined with the life-giving water she drew forth, securing the Jewish future, at least until the challenges of the next generation. Our generation, too, is at a crossroads. As did our forebears, we too worry about the Jewish future. We wonder if we are the last. And no different than our Torah reading, the future of our people will not be found by way of any single answer, but by finding those wellsprings of vitality and those Rebekah-like individuals capable of drawing out sustenance for a generation in need. Urebanim levanecha shalom al Yisrael. May we see children to our children and peace over all of Israel. May this, the greatest blessing our people have, be ours to enjoy as we work together by any means necessary to build a Jewish future our people so richly deserves. Shabbat shalom.